President Trump entered office earlier this year with the hope of bringing peace to the Russia-Ukraine war. He wanted to end the bloodshed and the suffering. He was motivated, he said so many times, by the dying and the killing and the destruction of European, Ukrainian countries and cities. But now then that seems to be gone. He tried many things. He was optimistic. He actually had an explosion against Volodymyr Zelensky in his own Oval Office in February. Then he had the meeting in Anchorage, Alaska with President Putin. And since that time, things have taken a significant turn for the worse. As we have been often talking about the fundamentals that lead to war-making capacity have always and irrevocably favored the Russians. The Ukrainian side has continued to diminish and lose its capacity, and there's nothing that can reverse those. So peace and the best negotiated settlement remain the only viable options to retain any kind of a Ukrainian state. But now it appears that the Trump administration has in some ways become Joe Biden. They instead of talking about ways to end the war, now President Trump and his administration only talk in increasing bellicose terms of forcing Russia into an end to the war on terms dictated by Washington and preferred by Kiev. That's what they have been saying and trying to do. It will never work. And we are literally setting ourselves up for disaster, both for Ukraine and God willing, or God forbid, also on the Western European side. If we keep going down this path, the likely outcome is war with Russia. That's a stark statement, but we have to go where the evidence leads. And right now, especially as of today, new information comes out, which makes this a much more alarming situation than it was before. And to try and make sense of what's actually coming out of Europe today, we have back with us Patrick Henningsen, host of Sunday Wire and patrickhennington.substack.com. Patrick, as always, welcome back to the show.
Great to be with you, Daniel.
Well, listen, I mean, let's just jump right into it here. I'd like your overall assessment of where this year started with Trump really putting a lot of emphasis, and obviously he did during the campaign, that he was going to end the war in a day and all that, where he started with a lot of his optimistic comments, and then as it turned out, where it is today. How do you see that transition happening?
Well, it's just that. They're just, you know, comments, optimistic comments. Many things have been said. You know, and if there's one thing we know about this president is his command of the news cycle is quite extraordinary. And the if you go back to his campaign in 2016, and he really, I think, realized and got a taste of the fact that they could, you know, flood the media zone, as it were, with various things, good, crazy, bellicose, over the top, didn't matter as long as it occupied news coverage. And then had the press basically chasing him all over the place. And they're still doing it. They're still chasing Trump. And then just as the press is maybe about to catch up on something, another outrageous thing is said or done or some comments made that completely flips whatever his previous position was. So he does this regularly. So what I've and some of my colleagues have come to realize and learn for a while now is not to pay attention to anything the president says. Nothing. And just to look at facts on the ground and to look at what the long-term overarching U.S. policy is, and then ask yourself the question, has anything changed in reality? Are there any material changes in the behavior of the U.S. government, its policies, and what it's investing into these various geopolitical flashpoints? And right now, it looks like the answer is, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in Ukraine, whether it's in the Pacific, I'd say the answer is not much has changed. In fact, we see escalation now. We're starting to see signs of real escalation. So, and the other thing is there's other fronts being opened up with this president. As if everything that you've mentioned there, Daniel, isn't enough on the plate, if there's not enough balls in the air, he is now talking about and making probably substantial moves with aggression towards Venezuela in the Western Hemisphere, but it doesn't end there. We're talking about inflaming the situation between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and in this very, very dangerous triangle that's now forming in Central Asia. So we're hearing comments by Trump like we want to reinvade Bagram Air Force Base. in Afghanistan. You better believe Pete Hegseth is all in with that. If not, if unless he, wouldn't be surprised if he's one of the driving forces in the administration to push for that kind of a cowboy, a root and toot and cowboy move. Because if you look at the situation right now, Pakistan is so important vis-a-vis Israel and Iran. You know, just imagine what the last U.S. strike on Iran would have looked like had the United States still be occupying Afghanistan and had some kind of military coordination with Pakistan. So there's that's a really complex piece. I'm happy to talk more about that later, but I don't see any improvement. Things are worse with Iran. They're worse in Gaza. They're worse in Syria. Tom Barak is openly baiting a civil war in Lebanon. Like, they're not even hiding it. They're like, we're going to arm the Lebanese armed forces to disarm Hezbollah. He's openly saying this publicly. So that's basically battle lines that are being drawn. I mean, there used to be some decorum and some sense of diplomacy, even with previous Republican administrations. But now you can see the mask is off. And what the U.S. were doing covertly before, or in conjunction with Israel, their ally, they're now doing overtly. That's the difference. So with regards to Ukraine, though, Daniel, of course, that is the most concerning because it involves two nuclear powers.
Right. Yeah. And you know, and I would argue that I would say instead of you can't listen to pay attention to anything Trump says, you have to pay attention with an asterisk, but you do have to pay attention because some of the things he says very often do result in actions later. And one of the biggest ones in this current time frame, and I want to show this again to kind of set up what came earlier today. And that is when a couple of days ago, President Trump talked about openly, maybe he's going to give tomahawks to Ukraine.
Do they want to have tomahawks going in their direction? I don't think so. I think I might speak to Russia about that, in all fairness. I told that to President Zelensky because tomahawks are a new step of aggression. Right? You understand that very well.
Are okay? You saying that you will speak to Putin first about
then
tomahawks?
I might talk to him. I might say, look, if this war's not going to get settled, I'm going to send them tomahawks. I may say that. The tomahawk is an incredible weapon, very offensive weapon. And honestly, Russia does not need that. They don't need that. Yeah, I might tell them that if the war is not settled, that we may very well do it. We may not, but we may do it. I think it's appropriate to bring up. Yeah.
I mean, look, and he even uses the term, this is a very offensive weapon. This is an aggressive weapon. So he knows how the tomahawk is going to be viewed. And yet he seems to be, I think partially is that he thinks that this is almost a wonder weapon. Like if we use this, no one can stop it because, well, when we've used it against, you know, I don't know, the military powers like Syria or Iraq back during the Operation Iraqi Freedom, et cetera, these things just went, almost all of them found their targets. Not quite the same thing if you end up using it against the Russian side, but I'm not sure that Trump is aware that those things aren't impervious.
Yeah, well, Syria shot down 24 of 28 with older than S-200 and Buk Russian, you know, air defense systems. So, I mean, and again, I think I mentioned this in a previous discussion. There's no way the United States is going to give their top of the range, whatever the latest, you know, whoever makes it, Lockheed Martin or Raytheon or whatever, they're not going to supply that to Ukraine for obvious reasons. So what is it? It's Trump threatening escalation. So this is the negotiation style of Trump. Is he thinks that the more he threatens Russia, that he can somehow bring them to the negotiation table. That's not negotiations. So, I mean, from this point of view, this is the fundamental flaw of Trump, unless this is the design of Trump. But there can never be any serious deals or negotiations, because to have any kind of if you want to bring this war to an end, that the United States is a co-belligerent, and it's this pretending that the U.S. isn't involved and that he's just a kind of neutral referee trying to, you know, resolve this dispute between these two former Soviet countries. It's not credible, because for Trump, if you can't even acknowledge the realities of how they got to the current situation, then the U.S. cannot be a partner in any, they can't construct a framework about how to get out of this situation. So the current constraints of this discussion, which are the main constraints, are the Trump administration. So they've come in, he says he inherited this conflict from Biden, but he cannot articulate how they got here. And so there's no way he can articulate an off-ramp. And if for Trump, the off-ramp is threaten the Russians, and if they don't submit, we're going to continue to escalate. And that's just a recipe for more dangerous confrontations. And with an increasingly irrational and desperate Ukrainian Zelensky regime. So it's a recipe for disaster, and he thinks he's in the driving seat. I beg to differ.
Well, and let me just reinforce that in terms of thinking he's in the driver's seat, because number one, Zelensky is very eager to show up here in Washington, D.C. in just about 48 hours from now to talk specifically about that. And as Gary just put up on this that headline a second ago, Zelensky's already meeting with the Raytheon and some of these folks who make the Tomahawk missiles. So you know exactly where his mind is. But much more to the point, and why I say it's important to listen to what Trump says, especially when you see what others in his administration say when they're talking about potential actions. And that was earlier today when Secretary of War Pete Hegseth met with a lot of his European colleagues to discuss ways that they're going to continue to support Ukraine. What he said in this piece here, he said a lot, but we're going to get to some of, other of it in a minute. But I want to start off with this here because this is a pretty solid shot across the bow directly to Russia.
All countries need to translate goals into guns, commitments into capabilities, and pledges into power. That's all that matters, hard power. It's the only thing belligerents actually respect. Your continued investment and leadership are vital to helping Ukraine defend itself and to bring an end to this conflict, peace through strength. Now, if this war does not end, if there is no path to peace in the short term, then the United States, along with our allies, will take the steps necessary to impose costs on Russia for its continued aggression. If we must take this step, the U.S. War Department stands ready to do our part in ways that only the United States can do. This is not a war that started on President Trump's watch, but it will end on his watch.
So that's pretty stark there. He flat says hard power is the only thing that belligerents understand. And this will end in peace, that we want peace through strength. He always says with that, you know, that false, you know, motivation and whatever. And then this will end on Trump's watch, and the Department of War will play its part. Those are some really, really strong, provocative words. What do you make of them?
He said hard power is all that matters. He said hard power is all that matters. What Pete Hegseth has left out of his great trope there is that by saying this, by renaming the Department of Defense to the Department of War, and I refuse to call it that. I mean, I just out of my own sort of conscientious protest there, he doesn't realize that to the rest of the world, he and the United States are the belligerents now. They clearly are. The statements of intent are clear, and they're adopting very Israeli-like, kind of extremely fascistic language that says there's no room for diplomacy. There's no room for negotiations. That if you don't submit right to whatever our agenda is or whatever we want, we're going to punish you. And if we can't punish you economically through sanctions, the implicit threat is we're going to punish you in the way that only the U.S. can. I mean, what's that mean? It means what, they're going to bomb Moscow? They're going to assassinate President Putin? I mean, what is he talking about exactly? Well, then we're back to the Cold War. Russia has a dead hand protocol, just like the United States does. And that's fully in place. And I would argue that Russia is more in tune with that type of war game. And even these latter generations post-Soviet are much more aware and understand the full implications of this. in the context of international conflict and geopolitics than the United States does. I really think you're in a very dangerous echo chamber in America. And I really, if I could, I would just reach out through the C-SPAN screen and slap all the Democrats across the face, because I don't see any real viable opposition to any of this madness coming from the other side of the aisle. And I'm saying that from somebody who is nominally conservative. You know, I've written off the Republican Party. I mean, forget about it. The anti-war wing is only about two congressmen and maybe a senator. But on the Democratic side, where are the conscientious voices? Where are the people that are going to balance this out? The American eagle needs two wings to fly. Otherwise, it's going to go into a tailspin, and you're witnessing that tailspin right now in front of our eyes.
And, you know, you go further, you know, with all of this belligerent talk, and when he says hard power is the only thing that matters, yeah, you're right. I mean, you can even use that two-winged analogy even on that. If you don't even have diplomacy on the table, if that's not even a viable alternative, then what is the only thing left for the other side to conclude? That they too must ramp up their military capacity, because there's no alternative for diplomacy. So the only thing you're giving Russia from a position of strength is either capitulate to our demands, or there's going to be more conflict. Now, I mean, no one on the planet in a human history from a position of strength and power is ever going to submit to somebody else because maybe they'll ramp it up here in their war. It's irrational. It's illogical. And yet, it's not just the United States, because now then here in NATO, this meeting here by the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte, is talking up the military arm of his ideas.
As we continue to ensure our own defense, we continue to support Ukraine. Their security is linked with ours. This is not just words, but it's reflected in the support we give to Ukraine. Thanks to funding from allies, we are providing Ukraine with critical U.S. equipment through the Prioritized Ukraine Requirement List, or PEARL. It is getting Ukraine the U.S. weapons it really needs to protect its people and to hold the front line. We started off even strong with six allies funding the first PEARL packages. And today, we heard from ally after ally about new contributions. More than half of NATO allies have now signed up, securing this crucial flow of support for Ukraine.
So he's talking about this so-called PEARL initiative. People may have heard of that. It's P-U-R-L, which is basically, we're going back to the Biden era. And what the Biden team did, and just, we always said that defense, the thing that it was called the Ramstein defense meeting. Now this is kind of a new one here, but it's the same thing. Everybody's come together to find out what they can give Ukraine to continue to fighting here. And interesting, because he says European security and Ukraine security are tied together. I want you to talk about this part first, because in my view, it is only connected because you make it connected, not that it is in reality. What is your view?
Well, we're having this conversation, and the reason it's so concerning, not just the fact that we have a proxy war in Ukraine that instead of being wound down in the first year of the Trump administration, it's now being escalated, and he's allowing the Europeans to escalate, which is disturbing in itself. But this is all being done in a vacuum, a void of no international treaties or agreements, all lapsed Soviet era missile agreements, bilateral defense agreements between the West and the Soviet Union, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, the INF Treaty, the Open Skies Treaty, all of these agreements that provided guardrails for this type of escalation. And I've said this on previous, I've said this for years about the game theory that's involved. And you alluded to this earlier. And so Mark Rutte, I mean, what is his qualifications for declaring war on Russia? Like, where was he 2 years ago? He was nowhere. He is a typical, limp-wristed European bureaucrat that has been put into that position in order to regurgitate bullet points given to him by the defense industry and probably by Washington. and who knows who else. But we're now in a strip away all the agreements, all the restraints, strip away the ideological framework that kind of kept the bipolar world somewhat balanced. At least it was capitalism versus communism. There was an ideological and political component, kind of made sense in that way. Now is this pure power politics, and the West is attempting to run a zero-sum policy with regards to those they deem their enemies. And if their enemies don't submit, or if their enemies gain anything, it's a loss on their side. So what happens when you take away the ability to talk, if the other party cannot resolve its grievances through dialogue, or in this case, it would be diplomacy? And this goes for Trump's political opponents at home. He wants to arrest, lock them up, or shoot at them rather than to have any political dialogue. So that's zero-sum politics at home, zero-sum politics abroad. It's going to lead to conflict. It just invariably does. And that's the number one thing that's missing here. And the other thing that's missing is the United States cannot expect that the current European leadership is going to somehow bail them out by providing some kind of a diplomatic off-ramp or something like this. There was always a chance in the previous international system that a France could, a Mitterrand or a Gerhard Schroeder or somebody, or Helmut Kohl, could step forward and provide some kind of a counterbalance or an off-ramp. And that kept equilibrium in the international system. It doesn't exist now with the European Union. It's everything. The thing about the European Union that worked during the Cold War is that every European country had its own foreign policy. Even though they're somewhat under the umbrella of the United States and NATO, there was still independent foreign policy. What's happened with the EU, it's congealed to a degree that there's almost no independent foreign policy amongst the EU. So it's not just NATO.
Yeah. When you see some like Slovakia, like Hungary or the Czech Republic or Romania, they get punished.
Yes. And so, and that could be one of the potential incendiary flashpoints, would be a new front in Moldova with Transnistria engineering some kind of a provocation there, or with Hungary. That's probably not off the table, is inflaming or organizing some kind of a provocative incident involving Hungary that would open up a kind of a new front of concern, let's say, that would then, you know, compel Washington to come in even deeper with more money and more arms. So I think we can expect that kind of thing. And we don't hear any moderate rhetoric coming from the UK. Certainly they want to ramp this up.
Yeah, no, nothing that, as you'll see here in a minute. I want to ask you, I want to go down a path you opened here a second, though. And I want to broaden the lens back out, not from just today's comments, but back out larger, not even back to 2022, but maybe going all the way back to 2014, when the Western, especially the United States, and certainly a lot of Europeans engineered to overthrow the legally elected government in Ukraine, Yanukovych, because he kind of liked the Russian side. He was leaning towards Russia instead of the Europeans. And, well, we can't have that. And the people who voted in that guy, well, we can't have that either. So we have to engineer it and undo it and throw them out and then install somebody that was of our pleasure, which, of course, we know Victoria Nuland and the ambassador openly talked about who we were going to put in there. So that's on the record. It's open, et cetera. What is our message, is my question to you. What is the theme? What is the vision that the West wants to accomplish here? Because here's all I see so far is that we're using to use lethal power, political subterfuge to get our way across here. And I want Russia to compel and submit to my way of view. And I don't give them any other alternatives. So I'm shoving them further away from any kind of European security architecture in which everybody gets to live in peace and possibility for having prosperity, to one in which only our side on our rules gets to live in peace, and the other side will either submit to it or will have conflict with us, possibly even war. How do you see, and if I'm mischaracterizing something, what is the vision and the message that Western leaders offer the world?
Well, what they're articulating here is a total break from the past, the total break of the post-World War II order that at least recognized that there should be some indivisibility regarding security, starting with Europe, considering the nuclear powers that have missiles pointed at each other, that there would be a security indivisibility that has to be in everyone's interest and not just one party's interest. The way the U.S. has positioned themselves now, it's a path to war. It's a path to war. There is no other, I don't see any other way that this is going to end unless they're playing chicken. And we all know what a dangerous game of chicken that is. And then even if you're playing a game of chicken with the Russians, they're still going to demand and ask for the same things. Because Russia's already thought this out, because it's an existential issue for them. They already know their priorities. They've already sent those to Washington in the communique to Tony Blinken in December of 2021. And it hasn't changed since that. And so for the United States, they don't know and that goes to your original question, Daniel. What is the vision? What is the vision? Is this has nothing to do. So there's no ideological. There's no ideological component. It's not free market capitalism versus communism. So there's not that. So what is this? Just total hegemony, total submission. Is this how do we describe this? It's a vanity project. So is this just a geopolitical vanity project for Western hegemony, for U.S. and Anglo-led Western hegemony? Is NATO's clearly turned into a vanity project for Europe, and they're struggling for their collective identity and ego with these organizations that are completely out of date. NATO should have been disbanded after the fall of the Berlin Wall, and instead they ramped it up. They NATO went into hyperdrive on steroids after the Cold War. And that's part of the reason why we are where we are. So if we look at the long range arc of US led policy from 1990 to the present, it paints a very dark picture. I mean, but there's always these opportunities to de-escalate, to veer away from confrontation, inevitable confrontation. But they haven't taken them. Instead, they just found creative ways to kind of continue the pressure on Russia. So again, it's an existential issue for Russia. It's not an existential issue for the United States. It's an existential issue for their collective imperial ego and hegemonic image globally.
And we seem to be exacerbating that and making it to where it could be an existential threat, where one yes. doesn't presently exist. Yes. And I mentioned this with Mark Rutte here, this Pearl issue. Secretary Hegseth also went a little bit further to explain exactly what that is. And we're going to get back into this whole power politics things. Watch this.
Firepower. That's what is coming. We expect it is coming from NATO. And it was a historic summit just a couple of months ago, brought about by leadership of President Trump to say, we need our allies to step up. And they did, and they have, in those commitments. Now those commitments will soon translate into capabilities, which is the most important aspect of it. And one part of that, of course, is Pearl, is the initiative where European countries buy U.S. weapons, transfer to NATO for the fight in Ukraine, to bring peace to that conflict. And if there's anything we've learned under President Trump, is the active application of peace through strength. Yes. You get peace when you are strong. Not when you use strong words or wag your finger. You get it when you have strong and real capabilities that adversaries respect.
And listen, let me just translate that into regular English or to regular speak. What he is saying there, and you, again, tell me if you disagree with this, he is looking Russia squarely in the face, which is who the recipient of this primarily is, and saying, you will compel and submit to our vision of what the world is supposed to be like, and you take your place in it, which is out of the way and not doing anything that we don't tell you to do, or we're going to ramp up military power and one day may use it against you. Do you see it any differently?
Yeah, well, his statement says it all. He says, if there's one thing we've learned through President Trump, it's that The only thing that works is peace through strength. You only get peace if you ramp up the strength. Where has Trump delivered peace? If you consider a genocide in Gaza, the hellscape in Gaza, you consider that peace? Might be peace for Trump on paper, but it ain't peace for the hundreds of thousands of dead Palestinians. I mean, it's a farce. Do you think there's peace in Ukraine? How many Ukrainians, they're still digging graves at an alarming rate in Ukraine for all of the conscripts that are ending up dead after 24 hours on the front line. Is that peace? Is that the kind of peace? Like, what's Hegseth talking about? They're starting wars and ramping up wars. Trump's going to break the record for new wars by the time his first year is finished. So you're dealing with people here that I think are just intoxicated on power. And it's this pissing contest. The Hegseth standing up there, cocksure, basically, yeah, we're gonna firepower, we're gonna deliver firepower. You know, and just how does this sound from a Russian or a Chinese point of view, or other UN Security Council members, or the rest of the world? They're like, well, clearly America's lost the plot. You've got a psychopath in the White House, and it's the sum of all fears for the rest of the world. And this bluff, this thing you can bluff your way to some kind of capitulation with nuclear armed states. I mean, this is it's beyond irresponsible, and Americans need to step up and admit and say that it's offensive. It's not offensive in the military sense. It's offensive in a political sense, and it should offend the sensibilities of civilized Americans first and foremost, if they still value their constitutional republic. Everything that Pete Hegseth is saying, the founders warned us about in America. The founders warned us about, and other erudite politicians have articulated over the years, including Ron Paul and others. And I can't believe I'm hearing this from somebody who's not even qualified to be head of the DOD or head of the Pentagon. Just clearly, if you took all of the qualified people for the head of the Pentagon and you stacked up their resumes, their CVs, I could probably get you 100,000 resumes, and his would be at the bottom if you went on pure qualifications. Yet he's selected for this position, and the disaster that you're seeing right now is what you're going to get. So this is what happens when you promote people to the level of incompetence. And these are people that are media actors.
Yeah.
So they're playing to the camera, but it's not just an act. It's not just an act. This has ramifications in terms of policy, in terms of how other countries are going to react.
Well, it does. And that's one of the things that Hegseth is really, really good at, and that is playing to the cameras. Obviously, he was skilled at that at Fox News for all those periods of time, why he was selected here, and how it's on display here. Now, I want to connect that with the danger of listening to someone like this, who obviously has the ear of the president, who also seems to be listening to him, or vice versa. It's really hard to know exactly what happens behind the scenes, but we do know for sure they seem to be on the same page here. This is what worries me a lot. You mentioned this a second ago. Hegseth talked about it today, in that this belief that what President Trump has done with military force so far has compelled adversaries to bend to his will. And here he makes, and I'm not making this up, you can see for yourself, Hamas and Russia in a similar vein.
I would also note a historic moment as well for a lot of things to happen, given what the president's been able to do in Gaza and throughout the Middle East. I think the world is seeing that we have a peace president who seeks that peace through standing by those that stand with the United States and stand for peace, which is what we saw there, and I hope we can see in Ukraine. So that's the focus of our efforts. We're going to be strong to bring that about.
We're going to be strong to bring that. So we coerced Iran. We coerced Hamas into doing what we wanted to there, so we can definitely do it to Russia. What do you make of that?
Oh yeah, he brought peace. Where? What peace? What peace? That is that the kind of peace that Hitler brought to Poland? Is that the kind of peace the Nazis brought to Belarus? Is that the kind of peace, you know, the Nazis brought to France? That's the kind of peace he's talking about. And if he spent more time reading history rather than looking at himself in the mirror, preparing himself for his press conferences, great hair, by the way, Pete, maybe he'd be able to understand some of these things. And another thing he might want to study is just basic game theory. And basic game theory says, when you threaten the other side, and this has been worked out, umpteen models, I have three books on my shelf that explain and model every single interaction in sanctions and also in military threats, that when you threaten the other side, you're not, if they expect that you're going to punish them, even if they agree or capitulate, which the United States has a record of doing, then they're not going to comply. Almost 90 plus percent of the time, the other party will not comply, whether it's sanctions or military threats.
And for those who may not know, I wonder if you could just kind of real briefly say, what is game theory? Because some people hear that and they think of like a video game or something, but it very much has to do with real life.
Yeah, it's modeling out every action has a reaction, and it's modeling out what the likely outcome of any type of altercation or argument or sort of fight will end in. And as many erudite military historians have said over the years, that war is an extension of politics by other means. So you have to look at it in its totality, political rhetoric, political diplomacy, negotiations, fighting, bombing is all part of the same. It's all part of the same continuum. So this is how Russia looks at warfare and diplomacy. And this is how many previous European leaders used to look at it. But we live in a different age where you have people that have almost high school level sophistication when it comes to international politics that are in positions of power. And that's a very dangerous thing because you have a big, big chasm between worldviews from the East and the West now. And I think there's so many unqualified people and charlatans that have been foisted into leadership positions in the West for various reasons. I think a lot of the talented people don't want to be in politics, and it's been like that for many decades. They don't want to serve their country because they've lost respect or they don't revere government as a noble career. So a lot of the smart, intelligent, talented people go to business and finance, whereas before they might have opted for serving their country, either in the diplomatic corps or in directly in politics. And so you just had a lot more considerate individuals, people that I think had a better depth and consideration of these issues than you do now. People that the chief envoy of the United States doesn't even know the regions, the names in Donbass, and kind of laughs it off publicly, like, oh, wow, I just didn't check. You know, I haven't had time to look at it.
Right.
You know, like that's where we're at.
That's important to know?
Kind of is. Yeah, it sort of is. It's just a basic mark of respect for the counterparty that you're meant to be negotiating with. What does that tell you? That tells you they have no, they don't care about the counterparty. Right. They don't care. They've got no respect for who's on the other side of the table. The only thing Trump cares about and his cabinet are photo ops. Signing ceremonies, photo ops, press conferences, victory laps. That's what they care about,
results. Patrick, one of the things that's curious, I mean, you talked a second ago about the resumes and the stacks of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who might be more qualified. In this day and age, especially in NATO itself, through some of the bigger powers, even the resumes that look like they ought to have the right kind of requisite skills, they also come to some, well, I mean, weird might be the best, or disconnected from reality might be the most appropriate way to characterize it, as exemplified at this same meeting here by British Defense Secretary John Healey, who seemed to be trying to be his best Pete Hegseth.
And Secretary Hegseth, I want to praise President Trump's essential leadership in securing that ceasefire in Gaza. That was peace secured through strength. And today, as we shift our focus back to the war in Ukraine. Your presence here reminds us of President Trump's commitment also to secure peace in Ukraine. But until peace comes, Ukrainians, military and civilians alike, continue to fight with huge courage. Our determination must match their defiance. Our support must match Putin's escalation. And our role as members of this UDCG is to guarantee Ukraine's strength.
So his view is the same as Hegseth and the same as the Trump, is that there's not even talking about negotiations, no diplomacy, absolutely off the table. Only strength. Only thing that we can do is to force Putin into compulsion. So first of all, I'd just like you to comment on how it seems like, whether it's Hegseth or somebody who is on paper qualified like John Healey or Mark Rucha or any of these other people, where does that leave the alliance?
Well, first off, you have to recognize the Orwellian language that these people are using in public. He's saying that our commitment must match the Ukraine's defiance. It's all based on lies. It's inverted. Ukrainians are defying Zelensky. They're resisting conscription. There's thousands of videos on social media for the last couple of years.
Thousands.
Where they're hog-tying delivery boys, DoorDash delivery boys, and trying to bundle them into vans to go to the front line. That's the defiance, is from the Ukrainian people. But you have a president who's unelected, who is running a police state, a full-blown police state, and his Praetorian Guard are Nazis. That's the reality in Ukraine. So what John Healey, what is he talking about? Is this virtue signaling, the same... They have these canned lines, these brave Ukrainians. They're feisty and they want to keep fighting. As long as they have the will to fight, we're going to arm them to the teeth. And then we'll show the Russians, you know, who's boss. And so that's the defiance. That's the real defiance. It's not that Ukraine society, if you look at even bias polling, most people in what's left of Ukraine want an end to the conflict. But yet we're backpedaling. Trump's backpedaled on all his campaign promises and said they're escalating. They want to escalate the war. And then Trump says publicly, oh, we're going to take the Donbass back and Crimea and maybe more territory. Like, what are you going to back the Ukraine to invade another failed Kursk misadventure or a Krynki disaster that the Americans and the British pushed the Ukrainians and had thousands of them perish? For no reason whatsoever. This whole thing could have been done in April of 2022, if not for the direct intervention of Boris Johnson and the United States intelligence agencies to egg on the Ukrainians to tear up the Istanbul Agreement at the time and fight the brave fight. The people of Ukraine have no say in any of this. They don't have elections. Zelensky is effectively a dictator. So what are we talking about? Are these Western leaders talking about when they're speaking for the Ukrainians? It's just unbelievable. And until peace comes. So what do you mean until peace comes? What is your definition of peace? Is it until Russia submits? Is that your definition of peace?
Well, and that's exactly where I wanted to go next, because the one thing that is completely noticeable by its absence is any, and unless I've missed it, you tell me if I have, but I don't see any of these people. I didn't see in any of the clips I looked through today, and I looked through a lot of video before we gathered these clips today, to where they say how this pearl and this whole mentality will compel Russia to do its will, where they say, all right, here's a logical path. If we do this, tomahawks, if we do this with more artillery, with more drones, some of the other things that are mentioned, this drone wall and some other things, if we do this, then that will then result in this on the battlefield, and Russia will then be pushing back. And instead of pushing back, they might have this idea that, okay, it would be in our interest to capitulate or accompanied with all of these additional new sanctions, or working on a 19th package right now, et cetera. They don't even go down that path. I have not heard any path other than these bromides that you just mentioned and these bumper sticker words, but that there's no rational path, idea, meaning these are just actions devoid of any even logic to how they can work. So where does that leave us?
it gets back to this is all tactical led policies and no strategic led policies. So Pete Hegseth is Donald Rumsfeld with a grease haircut on steroids. That's, you remember Donald Rumsfeld? We're going to be a slimmer, leaner military, and we're going to focus on small attack groups, and we're going to scale down and move more precise and more surgical. And that's how we're going to, you know, advance, you know, whatever our objectives are geopolitically vis-a-vis Iraq, etc. Okay, tactically led. But what's the strategic objective? What's the strategic vision? Then you're getting into worldview. Then you're getting into civilizational, philosophical questions. But these are things that used to be considered by statespeople, that used to be considered by very seasoned diplomats who spent their whole career working out these issues. And it used to be, and then the political class has to give orders to the military. Now Trump is trying to, I think, give a little bit too much deference to the hard power. And that's really, I think, indicative of a weak leader. That if the leader politically is extremely weak, i.e. he can't articulate deep concepts, or he can't inspire the public based on universal principles as previous U.S. leaders have done. We could name many of them, John Fitzgerald Kennedy, even FDR, and many others to a degree. Trump can't deliver that from his person, from his heart. He can't deliver that. So instead, he has to defer to the military, hard power, and the sort of intimidation, the international racketeering approach, okay? And so that's problematic on many levels. And that's the big difference, I think, that you're looking at here. I personally, I am framing this as the intellectual corruption and also a war on intellectualism. In the United States, but it's indicative, attacking universities and so forth, trying to strong arm institutions, academic institutions, so they're not independent anymore. That's just a symptom, I think, of a bigger issue that's at play here. And browbeating and shouting down and intimidating and threatening any potential opposition voices that might want to oppose what we're seeing here. And also just keeping them out of government. There's been a purge, or at least a denial of access, of plenty of qualified people that could be advising this president that are not. And sadly, you have to watch Judge Napolitano's program, or your program, Danny, or some of these other podcasts, and you see plenty of qualified people that could be steering the ship in a much better direction for the United States and for the world, but you don't have that. So we're all them, but the masses are showing up on these podcasts to hear sanity and to hear real alternative ideas and analysis. And so, but they're not getting it from government. So that gulf increases. The gulf under Biden was the gulf between the public opinion and the executive and the government. That's now only increasing under Trump.
Yeah.
So he's done the opposite of what he promised. He's done the opposite of what he promised and got the votes delivered for. So he's going to have to answer to his electorate, or at least he won't after 3 years, but the Republicans certainly will.
Yeah, let's just hope we can get to 3 years to where we can have that kind of an issue, because if a lot of these policies, come home to roost, or these seeds of disaster that are being planted could come up with some pretty bitter fruit before that day. We'll keep an eye on that. Listen, before I let you go today, I want to go back to something you mentioned at the beginning of this, and that's what is going on in the Middle East, and we're allegedly in peace in the Middle East has come, et cetera. And Trump declared peace, not just in Israel, Gaza, but in the entire Middle East. And now it's this wonderful thing. They had that big photo op at Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt over the weekend, where all the heads of state were there. But now then things are getting a little bit more dicey. And it's important to point out that even though he said peace has come, past tense, only phase one, which was actually the ceasefire and the exchange of hostages on both sides. That's the only thing that was really talked about then. All the phase two stuff hadn't even been negotiated yet. So it's a little premature, one might suggest, to say that. And then now, in addition to what Gary's showing here, we also have this one popping up here where Trump issues dire warning to Hamas. If they don't disarm, we will disarm them. Not that Israel would disarm them, but we would. What do you make of that?
Again, what's that going to look like? What exactly is that going to look like? So that can't happen. I mean, the last time the United States got their hands dirty in the Levant during Ronald Reagan's tenure, we know how that ended, and not well. So this would be orders of magnitude potentially worse, but it would also, it just puts the United States into a position of a casus belli, whereby one U.S. dead soldier in that kind of scenario would basically trigger, you know, a wave of indignation across America and disgust and calls for, you know, more, you know, attack. Oh, they're attacking Iran on the basis of a platoon of U.S. Soldiers got killed trying to disarm Hamas. I mean, it's utterly ridiculous. But Israel would love to put America in that position, you see.
Right.
Because that serves Israel's interest. I mean, that's music to Netanyahu and the Israeli lobby's ears. They would love to have the U.S. take the fall for that. And then that would embolden Israel and give them the justification, and it would double up support for Israel, whereby support for Israel politically in the U.S. is currently wavering because of the genocide in Gaza. So that would be something that would, you know, revitalize the special relationship with Israel and military support for what's going on. So, but alternatively, what Israel's done is just the aged old technique and tactic of gangs and counter gangs, which they learned from the British, which is to create militant forces and unleash them into there to cause infighting and false flag attacks and just general destabilization. So you noticed Israel's got no problem with any of that. So, but they've got plenty to say about Hamas. So what the people in Israel, in Lebanon and in Gaza, or what the Arab countries understand, is that if you disarm or if you lose your leverage, that you will be crushed. And that if Hamas disarms or the Palestinians disarm, that doesn't preclude some kind of a, you know, vicious attack or final solution by Israel. It doesn't. Although, you know, it looks bad, Gaza right now could definitely be worse if there was nothing. So, you know, I just listen to the Israelis. They don't support a Palestinian state. They don't support any self-determination. Their stated policy is they want to wipe and ethnically cleanse the Palestinians from Gaza. And Donald Trump and his son-in-law and Steve Witkoff have all at one point or another, along with Smoltrich and the others in the Israeli cabinet, have said they want to redevelop Gaza. It's not a secret. So how does that square with any long-term settlement with Palestinians? It doesn't. So you're just getting short-term rhetoric to get from A to B, and this thing could flip back to violence very quickly. I hope it doesn't. Danny, I hope it's a permanent ceasefire. I do. And Palestinians deserve to sleep at night, not have drones overhead 24/7, and not be bombed in their tents after their homes have been pulverized. They deserve that. But this could easily flip on a Monday or next week or next month, if it's convenient, and the Israelis and the American and the Trump administration believe that it's a convenient time to continue prosecuting that conflict.
And what in the last few minutes we have, I guess do you project as the risk of renewed war with Iran, or the possibility that somehow we can avoid it and things can, the status quo can continue on with that regard?
Well, the argument has been made by many an astute military analysts that this is this ceasefire is nothing more than a strategic pause in order to retrench and refocus on other objectives, one of which is preparing for a major strike against Iran, whether that's before Christmas or whether that's in the spring or later remains to be seen. but it certainly allowed Israel much needed time to regroup, to also look at their fighting forces and their reservists, of which the call-up responses have been diminishing over the last 2 years, rearm Israel, rebuild the Iron Dome, rebuild their missile defense array for the inevitable Iranian retaliation that would come after a strike by the U.S. and Israel. So that's, I think, strategically, those are the priorities for Israel and the U.S., is to prepare for an Iranian counterstrike. And so the U.S. want to move as many assets into place. And that's their priority. And then deal with Yemen if that rears its head again. And also to what they want to achieve with Hezbollah. So the finishing Hezbollah, destroying them, whatever, disarming them, that's still a high priority for the Israelis. So then it's a high priority for Washington. Yemen, ditto with Yemen, and all of that is important if the objective is to regime change in Iran. So this is what these people are working out right now. There's not a shred of desire for peace in the Trump administration, I'm sorry to say, because peace for them is scorched earth. Let's be honest. That's their vision. Their vision of peace is SpongeBob. You know, that's their vision of peace.
Yeah, which is pretty unlikely. And I'm sorry, just a couple more minutes there. Gary was showing a bunch of headlines here that I think deserve some commentary, that part of the deal was supposed to be for this permanent ceasefire was that Hamas would disarm, or that they would take advantage of the offer in the Trump plan of the amnesty to leave the Gaza Strip, et cetera. But you see that instead there's all kinds of, and that's just a deeply disturbing picture that we see on there. But there's lots of reports of Hamas not disarming, of continuing to exert control and a lot of fighting inside with the Palestinians, who are understandably and I think reasonably very angry at the Hamas side for perpetuating this war, because if they leave, at least there's a better chance for the peace. How do you see this internal dynamic inside of the Palestinian enclave?
Well, first of all, we have to look at what we're looking at on screen here. We have to determine how much of it is Israeli and U.S. propaganda. In other words, what is the video we're looking at? Who is actually being executed? Is it the groups that Israel admitted, the ISIS factions that admitted its arming in Gaza, that were stealing food and selling it back to Gazans at extortionate rates? Is that who's being executed here? Or are these collaborators, Mossad or Shin Bet collaborators, or what exactly we're looking at? It's hard to tell. We all should try to drill down a little bit and find out what we're looking at here. It is coming from the Times of Israel, but this is really important to look at this, because we're going to get more of this type of information warfare here. And what they're doing here, and you can tell straight away from the headline, they're trying to, the Israelis and the Americans want to draw a line between Gaza and the West Bank, or from the Palestinian Authority, the PA, and what's in Gaza, Hamas and the Al-Qassam brigades, etc. Because their ultimate goal is to PA-ify, if you will, the Gaza Strip. So they want to disarm it, have their own trustee police force run by Israel that then shoots Palestinians, which is what they do in the West Bank. The PA act as enforcers for Israel. And so they have that completely under control, and then move in the settlers and build the settlements, that or the real estate developers, and build Dubai, as Kushner and co want to do, and Blair as well. So, I mean, that's their vision of if any Palestinians are allowed to stay in Gaza, that would be their future in parts of Gaza. It would be a PA West Bank type existence that basically has an expiration date. The West Bank has an expiration date. Israel's clear about what they want to do. They've already partitioned the West Bank. They've already broken up further. They've already isolated East Jerusalem. They've already isolated the Jordan Valley. And the hard right in Israel have already said what they want to do. They want to push. They'd love to do what they're doing in Gaza, which is kill a large percentage of the population. Whoever's left, push them into Jordan. Push them into Jordan. And that's more feasible than pushing them over the Rafah border, because Egypt doesn't want to inherit a generational Palestinian refugee issue, whereby Jordan already has 60 or 70% of its population of Palestinian origin already. So that wouldn't be this, it wouldn't be as tumultuous for Jordan, although it would destabilize the current monarchy for sure. And that's another discussion. But the Israelis believe that this is feasible in the future. They're telling the West what they want to hear this week, but they have a plan for what they want to do in 10 years, and nobody's listening.
Right. Yeah. Well, we're going to have to leave it right there for right now. But as always, really appreciate you coming on and providing such stark clarity to some of these tough issues so that we know the truth and that we at least are aware of what's happening and gives us a chance to try and weigh in if we get a chance. But always appreciate you coming on with this analysis. Thank you very much.
Great to be with you, Danny.
And we appreciate you guys, too. We're going to have live from Moscow, actually, later today. At 3 p.m., Larry Johnson, Larry the Shirt, is not going to be in his normal digs today because he is in Russia, and we're real eager to hear what he has to say because basically, as we showed you earlier, the U.S. War Department versus Russia, lots of threats going on, and we haven't seen any reaction yet from the Russian side. I've been looking for that before we came on the air here, but I'm guessing that Brother Larry is going to have something for us to say. Do not miss this one, folks. Tune in at 3 p.m. today on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.